Thanks, Shane. Thank you very much.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Winsult us.
Good morning, good Phoebe. Good afternoon on this Wednesday afternoon. How are you? 51551 for your text. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. Sally Hayden's book, My Fourth Time We Drowned, won the On Post Irish Book Awards Book of the Year. It is an amazing book. I read it over Christmas. I've been meaning to tell you about it because it made such an impression on me. It's one of those books that you think everybody should read. By coincidence, I was coming out of the supermarket one day and I'd read Sally Hayden's acknowledgements and I recognised one of the names and I saw this person one day and I said, oh, I've read Sally's book. And anyway, it turned out that it was Sally's mother. I hadn't put two and two together. And I told her in very effusive terms what I thought of her daughter's book. And she said, oh, she could come in. Oh, I said, great. Would she? So Sally's here today. My Fourth Time We Drowned, Seeking Refuge on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. It is one of those books that will just stop you in your tracks. And it's a real education. And it would change, definitely it changed my view of the world. Anyway, we'll be talking to Sally in about 20 minutes' time. After 4 o'clock, we'll be speaking to our relationship experts, Alison Keating and Ray O'Neill. And when I say relationships, that's not confined to couples. We also talk about relationships between siblings and parents and work colleagues and friends and all sorts of things. They're good on all that, anything that involves a relationship. And Alison and Ray will be with us after 4 o'clock. And if you are going through something and you need some advice from them, ray@rte.ie. It's free and anonymous and all that sort of thing. And they're very good. They don't always agree, but they always give sound advice, Alison and Ray, after 4 o'clock. Now, it is the week of St. Patrick's Day. It's Friday. And are you going to do something on St. Patrick's Day? I was talking to a man coming down to studio today and he was saying, well, it's weather dependent, Ray, weather dependent. Because the forecast is that it's going to be mild. So we're talking about, in some places, mid-teens for St. Patrick's Day, but there are showers forecast. You can handle showers, but you can't handle rain. Anyway, the journal.ie are asking people today, are you going to do something to celebrate St. Patrick's Day? It's a big question. It's an important question. What would you think? What would you think on that? Well, as it turns out, the majority of people say no, not doing anything to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. That's 59.6%. And yes, say we are going to do something. You see, not every place has a parade, so you may have to travel. And then 8.8% are probably weather-dependent people. They say, not sure yet. We'll keep an eye on the weather. They didn't say that. I'm just surmising. So that's that. It's a day off as well for a lot of us, and that's nice. A three-day weekend. Yeah, thank you very much. Bring it on. Just the details of the visit to the White House. Sean Daly is the man responsible this year for making the bowl. Sean has been doing what he does brilliantly for the last 50 years. He was 15 when he walked in to the gates of Waterford Crystal as an apprentice. He now is the master craftsman and he runs Dingle Crystal down there in Kerry. And so it's a lot of effort, a lot of work went into this, and it draws inspiration, or he drew inspiration, from the Beehive Huts in the early Christian monastery of Skellig Vihil. The bowl was mouth-blown, hand-cut and hand-polished before being engraved. So that's over there already, I would imagine, in Washington. And the shamrock, I don't know if that's en route or over there. The shamrock that will fill the bowl is also from Kerry, from the Kerry Gaeltacht. Irish Plant International have been providing shamrock for the special occasion for the last 28 years. So kudos to Joe Shukru and the hardworking team in the glass houses there. So that's they're the people who are responsible. And on Taoiseach Leo Varadkar will be presenting that to the President, Joe Biden. And he's in the news today. Well, he was in the news all week because he's coming. He's a coming. Next month he'll be here. And already there's the chat, Mayo, Louth, Belfast, where, when, how long, da-da-da-da-da. He's in the news today because he has said that Jimmy Carter, former president, now 98, has asked Joe Biden to do the eulogy at his funeral. So the quote is, he asked me to do his eulogy. Excuse me, I shouldn't say that. So he corrected himself, stopped himself. Jimmy Carter's 98. He's the longest lived US president, and he announced February this year that he would spend his remaining days at home receiving end of life care for going further medical intervention after a series of short hospital stays. That's a big thing to be asked to do, to do a eulogy. A lot of pressure. And although the person is dead, you feel obliged to respect their memory. And they're sort of on your shoulder, I would imagine. I've never done a eulogy, but I would imagine the person is on your shoulder. And you can feel them listening to every word you're saying about them. And it's a difficult thing to do. I was at a funeral today. A work colleague's dad died, and we wish them all well. You're in our thoughts. And one of his many daughters, because from a family of 13, did the eulogy. And she did it brilliantly because I got a real sense of the man who I didn't know that well. It was touching in parts. It was funny in parts. There were a couple of tears near the end. And it was just the tone, pitch perfect. It's a difficult thing to do. I remember talking to somebody who had done a similar thing, provided the eulogy at their dad's funeral. And to this day, I regret the fact that they didn't talk more about him, that they talked about their relationship with him as opposed to him as an individual. So it's a difficult thing to do. So that's that. Just on death, I suppose, would you know what the Fosbury flop is? In which sport would one use the Fosbury flop? High jumping, well done. Well done, yes. And it's named after Dick Fosbury, and Dick died this week, 76. An American high jumper. 6'4". Before Dick did what he did back in 1968, everybody just ran at it and jumped the way you would do it, the way a horse would do it at the Dublin Horse Show. And Dick thought he had reached his heights, you know, that the bar had gone as high as it was going to do. And then he started experimenting with various things. And he happened upon this thing where he ran at the fence, turned around, flopped over it, and then flicked his 2 feet over the bar. And it was successful for him. And a local paper reported that this guy, Dick Fosbury, had flopped over the high jump, and that's where the name stuck. He sort of presented his style to the world at the Mexico Olympics in 1968, 2.24 metres. And it was an Olympic and US record of 2.24. He never matched that in his full career. And to mark the 50th anniversary of his famous win in Mexico, he's quoted as saying, "I thought that after I won the gold, one or two jumpers would start using it, but I never really contemplated that it would become the universal technique. Yet it only took a generation." And prior to the Fosbury flop, as far as I know, there was no crash mat on the other side of the high jump. So they just jumped over and landed on their feet. And then, of course, when Dick did what he did, for fear of children copying him and getting injured, they put a crash mat on the other side. So Dick Fosbury, may he rest in peace. There's an odd one. A New York-based designer. Is it Christian Cowan or Cowan? Cowan, C-O-W-A-N. She's announced a collaboration with the Teletubbies. Yes, the 90s children TV show. Which ran during the 90s, stopped at the beginning of the noughties.
I'm the Teletubbies.
Oh, I remember it well, those afternoons on the Den, introducing Teletubbies. Did I? I don't know if I did. I can't remember if they were on when I was on. Anyway, so you can pay, if you have it, £2,000 sterling for a pair of slime green boots. Which one of them was the green one? See, there you go. I'm looking at them here. My word. Yeah. That's mad. Sort of Dipsy. So Dipsy, I love your Dipsy boots there. I love your Dipsy boots. How much to pay for them? You'd have to be embarrassed to pay that much for a pair of boots, would you? Would you not be? I definitely would be. This is sort of not related but related, in that we're talking Tinky Winky, Dipsy and Poe. Wiggle Wriggle. What would you say? Would you say I need some wiggle room on that? Or would you say I need some wriggle room on that? Oh, yeah, you see, you don't know, do you? Yeah. Dan Walker from the BBC posed that question on Twitter. And I don't know. I think I've probably said both over the years. Yeah, you get a bit of wiggle room there in your tinky-winky boots, your dipsy boots, your wriggle room. Anyway, the phrase, just so you'll know in future, the phrase is wiggle room, not wriggle room. You would have thought it was wriggle room. It refers to flexibility of action, not physical flexibility. To wriggle is to move uncontrollably. Wiggles are more purposeful. Let's wiggle our way out of that. Yeah. There, it's wiggle and not wriggle. You can take that with you now and entertain people over the bank holiday weekend. The place to be this Thursday evening, Ray, St. Patrick's Eve, is Clonus for the St. Patrick's Eve Parade, Festival of Light and Fireworks display, growing from strength to strength for the last 10 years. And that's our good friend, Tony Morgan from Lipton's Clonus. Thanks for the calendars, Tony. He always sends us in a handful of calendars. And good wishes to St. Mary's Brass and Reed Band from Kingscourt, who will be leading the Cavan Association in this year's St. Patrick's Parade in New York, up Fifth Avenue. And we'll be touching in with a few of the smaller parades around the country. And if you have a parade and you want some national publicity for it, do let us know about it. ray@rte.ie, ray@rte.ie. Now, a tune that makes me proud to say I'm Irish. All Kerry today, Cormac Begley from the Dingle Peninsula, the Jimi Hendrix of the concertina. Rolling in the Barrel, O'Neill's March. That's, you'll recognise that from Put 'Em Under Pressure. And there's one other one in there as well, Tralee. That's the great Cormac Begley. Now, what's that epic tune on the accordion that has me dancing here in the office under the desk? You see, you can't. Dancing, smiling, clapping, tapping, everything. That's, it has it all there, and it's one man and one instrument. It's just amazing. And the energy. I love that. Love it. Anyway, we're looking for two people to come on after 4 o'clock and be part of our Who Done It quiz. Yeah, two quizzers, three whodunit questions, each on music, sport, books, politics, inventions, anything that involves human endeavour. And like all whodunits, there will be clues. If you answer without a clue, you get two, because it's more difficult. With a clue, it's easier. You get one for a correct answer. And there's a prize. And it's a luxurious break for two to Foda Island Resort in Cork, nestled at the heart of a peaceful island, surrounded by gorgeous scenery and just 8 miles from the bustling city of Cork. Pack your bags and escape to your own private island with Foda Island Resort. It's a two-night stay for two people, dinner one evening, the Amber Lounge, loads of things to do. There's a swim pool, world-class spa, the exclusive Cove restaurant, there's a golf course, then the environs, Foda Wildlife Park, Foda House and Gardens, the world-class English Market in Cork, and Ballymaloe out the other direction, Ballycotton out the other direction. FodaIsland.ie, FodaIsland.ie. Here's your qualifying question on this Wednesday afternoon. Which traditional Irish gift will be presented to US President Joe Biden this week? Will it be a shamrock bowl or a shamrock bath? So which traditional Irish gift will be presented to US President Joe Biden this week? Will it be a shamrock bowl or a shamrock bath? 0818715925. That's 0818715925.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Whoops, there's the bottle gone. Gavin has been on Yall County Cork having a Mardi Gras themed parade starting 3 o'clock. Breton Road, Yall. That's Gavin. And hope all is well, says Brian in Athy. Athy St. Patrick's Day parade from 3 o'clock Friday. 30 floats, bands, DJs and loads of fun. Up Kildare. Go on the Lily Whites. Yeah, we're looking for two people to come on after 4 o'clock and take part in our Who Done It quiz. Great prize. It's a great prize and perfect time for a break down to Foda Island for two people. Loads of things to do down there. And your qualifying question today is which traditional Irish gift will be presented to US President Joe Biden this week by Leo Varadkar? A shamrock bowl or a shamrock bath? 0818715925. That's 0818715925. Now, another quick look at some of the smaller parades happening around the country on Friday. A bit of that, yeah. Thanks for all your emails so far. Keep them coming in. The man who will be St. Patrick for the Clondaloon float at the Fermoy Parade is on the line. Hello, St. Patrick.
Hello, big army Jesus. How are we all up there?
Padraig O'Flynn, it's yourself.
It is me indeed. How are we?
Top of the afternoon to you. We'll have to stop this.
Top
ridiculous.
Top of the afternoon to you, is right.
Now, Clondaloon, I've never heard of it. I'm sorry, I've never heard of it.
Clondaloon is a beautiful small village on the Blackwater. Our Fiumny Cool used to play the hurling down there, and the old Seminar Knowledge used to swim up and down the river, and it is a stunning spot.
Right, and is it Clondaloon or Clondaloon?
Clondaloon.
Clondaloon, right.
Clondaloon, yeah.
Clondaloon. How do you spell it, Podge?
C-L-O-N-D-U-L-A-N-E.
Aha, Clondaloon. I had it wrong there. Sorry about that. Apologies. So what's the population of Clondaloon?
The population of Clondaloon is 403.
Right, that's quite specific. Thanks. And you're bringing most of that population into Fermoy, is it? Or are you having the parade in Clondaloon?
We're having the parade in Fermoy. It's the first time in 20 years that the village has been involved in the parade.
Right, okay.
And we've nearly got just below 200 people coming into the village with us, which is amazing, you know.
That's half the population going into Fermoy.
Yeah, half the population, yeah. Yeah. We've the national school is heavily involved. We've got 90 young students down there.
Right.
So mammies and daddies are joining them, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And you're St. Patrick. You're St. Patrick.
I'm St. Patrick.
You have the full regalia, have you?
Well, we've got the crossover, yeah. And we're going for a kind of a demon, kind of a younger St. Patrick.
Right.
Because I'd say back in the day, St. Patrick didn't walk around into Fermoy and Clondaloon all blinged up with gold.
No,
and,
you're right. You're probably right.
Until he became the saint.
Yes.
So we're going for the more Viking, pagan, druid kind of thing, you know?
Aha, raggle taggle.
Yeah. Yes, this is the one, yeah.
Yeah. So after 20 years, and why the gap?
And because we're like a small village, two kilometres away from the town,
yeah.
That we've got hurling clubs, soccer clubs, GA clubs, swimming clubs, scouts, basketball clubs, that all the young kids are all active in them, and they normally go on the parades, you know?
Yes, and so you're going to go as a group, Clondaloon.
How
big is the Fermoy parade, Podge?
Fermoy parade would have... maybe 1,000 people marching.
Ah, right. Okay.
So it's quite big for us, you know.
Stay where you are, because we've Sean Halford on, and Sean is the Grand Marshal for Gorey St. Patrick's Day Parade this year. How are you doing, Sean?
Very good, Ray.
Yes.
Very good. Yeah. Really looking forward to the day.
Yeah, say hello to Podge there.
Hi, Podge. How are you doing? I'm delighted to hear that you're organising a parade this year. It's very, very important for all communities. Get out and celebrate the Saints' Day.
Yeah, and you've been organising the Gorey St. Patrick's Day Parade since 1980.
Well, I was on the original committee and I was involved for a long number of years, Ray, and I took a break the last couple of years, but I've been nominated this year because our family business, Halford's Hair Studio, are 100 years in business.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Really looking forward to the day.
So you've been cutting hair in the Gorey area for 100 years as a family?
Yeah, the fourth generation. My grandfather, Leo Halford, came to Gorey in 1923. My father, Noel, took over in 53. And my wife and I in 93. And our daughter now is running the show, May, if she's the youngest of the family.
May, yeah. And listen, Sean, is there a connection with Harry Darling from Kildare?
Yes, Harry Darling... My grandmother Violet was a darling from the Curragh, and she was an aunt of Harry's.
Right.
And Reggie's, and they still have a barbering business on the Curragh.
Yeah.
Many generations. They're there since 1906.
And the
Halfords and Darlings must be doing something right. They're still around.
So there was a Violet Darling you mentioned there, because I went to school with a Grace Darling.
Yes, well, now Grace would have been a niece of... Violet.
Aha, right, yeah. Yeah, I got my hair cut back in the day by Harry himself.
Yes, and Reggie and Harry. Harry was Reggie's father, and then Reggie's a great historian.
Right. Okay, so will you be in a car or a horse and cart, or what way are you travelling?
No, I'm in a car, a 1944 Citroen that was kindly loaned to me by... Vinnie Walton.
Nice.
And Vinnie has two cars. We're also putting an entry in ourselves. I'm the eldest of a family of eight, so I'm hoping to have all our family there on the day, and their children, my nephews, nieces, and our grandchildren. So the fifth generation of, right. of Halfords will walk the street on Patrick's Day.
I'm sure your float will win because it'll be a cut above, it'll be a cut above the rest. Yeah. Sorry, lads, I apologise. Listen, we've Podge on from Clondalane and we've Sean off from Gorey. Rebecca Brew, where are you?
I'm here in County Clare, Ray. How are you?
Good, good. Kilrush, I believe.
Kilrush in County Clare.
Yeah, and what's
looking
happening?
Looking forward to our parade at 3 o'clock on Friday.
Right, how long
and
has that been going?
We're going, you know something, parades in Ireland are going for 120 years this right. very year.
Ah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, came about as a means of trying to let the English know we had enough of them and to celebrate our Irishness.
Very good. Very good. And what's your role in the Kilrush Parade?
I'm the joint compere on stage with a lovely man called Brian Clossy.
Right.
And you know, our Grand Marshal is none other than our very own Michelle Dillon.
Aha.
We share her with the Meteorological Service.
Yes, yes, yes. So she's the Grand... Great.
She's the Grand Marshal with the children from her local school in Knockerra, Knockerra National School.
And what's she saying about the weather?
Well, they're going to be all dressed up in sort of sunshine, I believe. But look, if we get a few drops of rain, we'll cope.
Yes, you will. Okay. Well, thanks to you all. Podge, I forgot to ask you, Podge, how is St. Patrick travelling?
St. Patrick's on foot because we're a greener, cleaner village, you know?
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, okay. And you're in your Citroen, Sean. And,
yeah.
and Rebecca, you'll be up there with the microphone telling people what's in the Kilrush Parade. Thanks, you all. Happy St. Patrick's Day. See you next time. Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, My Fourth Time We Drowned is a book by Irish journalist Sally Hayden. The book writes about the harrowing first-hand accounts from people currently living in Libyan detention centres and began with a Facebook message which Sally received asking for help from an Eritrean refugee. It's now been published in paperback and it won, as I said earlier on Post-Irish Book of the Year 2022. And Sally joins me now in studio. Good afternoon, Sally. And first things first, congratulations. You've been nominated for a Helen Bernstein Book Award for Excellence in Journalism.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Is that just today?
Yeah, that was today. And that's awarded by the New York Public Library for books, journalistic books that contribute to public opinion, understanding of issues. So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is pretty amazing. So you're local, aren't you?
Yeah, originally from Clonskey.
Yeah, yeah. Where'd you go to school?
To St. Killian's German School.
Right.
And Our Lady's Grove.
Yeah, and were you always going to be a journalist?
I don't think so. I mean, I was always interested in kind of how the world works and in reading. Like, I started reading fiction and then moved on to non-fiction. And actually, in Our Lady's Grove, I was involved in setting up a newsletter. We called it the Grove Gazette. So now when I think back on it, probably I was interested in journalism. But at the time, I didn't really know how you became a journalist. So.
The question people ask, is there journalism in the family?
No.
No journalism in the family, right. So what did you do in college?
I did law in UCD.
Right.
And then international politics in Trinity.
Okay. And then where did your journalism career begin?
I mean, so actually when I was in transition year, I won an award to do a week's work experience in the Irish Star. And then I kind of kept trying to write and interning when I could. But yeah, like I said, I wasn't totally sure how you actually became a journalist. And then I ended up working interning in CNN, then in Financial Times, and then I got a staff job in Vice News in London in 2014 and worked there for about 2 years.
And Vice is a website, a news website.
Yeah, I mean, they have a TV show as well. Right. They had a TV channel, but I think it might have closed down. I'm not sure.
Okay. And is that where you started getting interested in migration?
Yeah,
and refugees?
So exactly. Basically, I was reporting on everything. Like at one stage, I was the only staff writer outside the US. So I literally had to cover everything. And I was there in 2015 when David Cameron, the Prime Minister of UK obviously, said that there were swarms of migrants in Calais who were trying to cross into the UK. And my editor, I had kind of been itching to go do anything basically that wasn't desk-based.
Yeah.
And my editor said, why don't you go to Calais and just figure out what he's talking about? Because we couldn't, you know, it's a kind of typical dehumanizing news coverage or, political statements.
Swarms of refugees.
Swarms of migrants, I think he said. And we were like, well, we need to know, like, who are these people? Why are they trying to get here? What are they doing? What's going on? And so, of course, I went out. I had been given like 1,000 business cards by Vice, which I had never really had the chance to use. And I went out and just realized this situation was so much more complex than, you know, any of these sound bites could convey, that there were people coming from all over, fleeing such a massive range of different situations, who basically just were stuck because they didn't have the ability to get on a plane and fly somewhere like we do as Irish people. And I handed out my business cards. I ended up with so many contacts from so many different countries and just told people, stay in touch, you know, let me know if there's anything we should be covering. And that was basically where my focus on migration began. I didn't actually decide, you know, that I was going to have this focus, but it was just developed.
But you were pulled into it, though.
Yeah, in a way.
By human tragedy, by human stories, by human resilience. Because a lot of the stories, like to get from where they were originally to Calais was like, it's jaw-dropping. They defy all sort of logic, don't they, a lot of the stories?
Yeah, and I think when you say I was pulled into it, it was more that I was just talking to people. Like I just went out and started talking to people, and I became very quickly aware that the kind of public understanding of these situations is very removed from the actual reality. And there's so much kind of othering language being used. Even the term refugee, migrant, it's, you know, actually it's just people, like we're all people, right? But these terms kind of allow the general public to distance themselves from the fact that people are stuck in these really terrible and impossible situations. And, you know, I guess I've kind of felt that it's important to keep reporting what I find in terms of correcting that narrative, I guess. But yeah, you could say my other reporting stemmed from there, but it wasn't. It was just the fact that I went out and talked to people and they started contacting me as well.
And their stories brought you to Africa, to their origins, if you like, did it?
Yeah, I mean, so I ended up doing like this big investigation on Syrian refugees and what happens to Syrians who try to go back home. And one of the things that we uncovered, and I traveled to Syria for it, was that people who tried to return were being arrested at the airport, tortured, locked up, and then sent to the front lines to fight.
Why?
Because like the regime that's in control there basically was both punishing them for coming back, and you know, it's like an incredibly abusive regime. But I thought that that was kind of a missing point, because we always hear in Europe they'll be like, why don't they go home? And actually I thought it was important to show that people were trying to go home, and this is what was happening to them. And that was my first big investigative migration related work. And it won the EU Migration Media Awards first prize, and as a result of that I got some, you know, a bit of grant money to do further work, and it kind of developed from there.
Now, not to be too glib about it, but you became known for work on migration. And as a result, we're skipping on a few years now to August 2018. Was it a Facebook message you got? Hello, sister.
Yeah, I got a Facebook message. It was 26th, I think, of August 2018. And it just said, hi, Sister Sally, we need your help. We're under bad condition in Libya prison. If you have time, I'll tell you all the story. And, you know, this just came out of nowhere. I didn't really know who had sent it. I didn't really know why they would be contacting me, or, you know, whether it was true, or, you know, how they had a phone or anything like that. But I basically just started messaging with the man. And yeah, what I uncovered, I mean, like I said, I had been reporting on migration for a few years, but it completely shocked me. He said he was among 500 men, women and children that they had been locked up in a migrant detention center, what he called a prison, in Libyan capital Tripoli, that they had all tried to reach Europe to cross the Mediterranean and try and get to Italy or Malta. And they had been caught at sea, forced back, locked up indefinitely, not charged with anything, and then abandoned without food or water. And they were basically afraid they could starve to death or they could be killed, and they just needed help. And they were like, please tell the world what's happening to us. And I obviously, you know, tried to verify this, like I did verify it, took steps to do that. But what, you know, and people obviously can read the books. I'm a lot more eloquent in that than I am at speaking. I'm not a broadcaster, but...
Well, you're a brilliant writer and a brilliant journalist, so...
Well, thank you. Yeah. But yeah, what that sparked was literally years of reporting. And my contacts got passed around many of these different detention centres, and people with hidden phones started sending me evidence of crimes against humanity that were taking place. Like I said, it turned out as a direct result of European Union migration policy.
Well, let's talk about, because there's loads of things to, because this book is just not the story of people travelling from places like Eritrea and Somalia up through Africa to Libya and then trying to get across to Europe, across the Mediterranean. It's also uncovering large organisations that people would assume are doing the right thing by people who are trying to flee war-torn countries, and maybe they're not, there are question marks over that. And you mentioned there the EU. So I'm just remembering back to when there was an Irish Navy vessel in the Mediterranean, and we were getting loads of pictures back of them rescuing people who were trying to make the trip from Northern Africa to Italy or somewhere else in Europe. And then that all went silent. And you explain why in the book.
Yeah, I mean, basically what has been happening is that the EU has been making huge efforts to stop refugees and migrants from actually reaching European territory, where many of them would be able to make a claim for protection. And they're doing this, you know, and a lot of European politicians have spoken to me and reached out because of my reporting, and a lot of them are actually quite supportive of the book. But what they will say is that the European public does not want people arriving. And obviously what they're talking about is a specific type of, you know, it's, you know, a specific type of migrant or refugee. And like I said, it is kind of othering in a way because, you know, specifically they'll be like, particularly like African migrants, black people, or, you know, people coming from certain countries, the general public does not want them arriving. And so what is happening is that the EU is circumnavigating international law. What they're doing is flying drones, helicopters, planes above the central Mediterranean. They're spotting the refugee boats or migrant boats, and they're then supporting the Libyan Coast Guard to intercept the people on those boats. And the people are then, and it's been like since this policy started, more than 115,000 men, women and children are caught, forced back to Libya, and often locked up indefinitely in detention centres that Pope Francis, among others, has compared to concentration camps. And this is... You know, this is EU policy. This is like literally EU policy is
so they're funding the Libyan Coast Guard to police the seas off the coast of Libya to make sure that no migrants cross the Mediterranean into Europe.
Yeah, exactly. And also conducting their own surveillance.
On top of that.
Yeah.
And they're going back into war-torn Libya, which is a bit of a mess.
Yeah.
That's an understatement. And they've been held in these detention centres. Who's running these detention centres?
Militias. So Libya is like not a functional state, and it's basically controlled by militias, and the detention centres are run by militias.
Right. Now, can we just go back to the origins? Where are these people coming from, and why are they leaving their countries?
So there are people escaping like a huge range of different situations, you know, war, dictatorship, fleeing countries like Somalia, like Sudan, also countries in West Africa that would be more likely places where they're fleeing extreme poverty, like Sierra Leone, where I actually spent a lot of time reporting the book. But in those situations, and I mean, it made me think a lot as well about this term economic migrant, for example. There are people who like are escaping a situation where you don't have any healthcare, for example. So they might be in a country where the life expectancy is 25 years or more or less than it would be if they were in Europe, or you can't get, you know, I was there during COVID, like there were no functional ventilators to treat people who needed them. You know, a huge number of children die under the age of 5. People don't have enough food. So, you know, I think it made me reassess also this idea of what is a risk to life. But yeah, a lot of the people, like I said, and particularly the ones I was in touch with, would actually have like legitimate refugee yes. claims. So once they can get to European territory, they can claim the right to be there.
And economic migrants is used as a sort of a put down, isn't it? That they're just coming over here to take our money and our jobs. Isn't that, it's another othering one, but it's a very focused othering.
Yeah, and I actually say in the author's note of the book, I mean, I was an economic migrant. I left here when we were having our economic crisis and went to London to look for a job. And I don't know, like when I like the chance to write a book was interesting for me because I had the chance to actually examine the language that's being used and think about it myself and think about how I use it as a journalist and what do these terms like economic migrant or expat, you know, a lot of white people in Africa are called expats, but why do we call them that when they've gone there to make money? And then we call someone an economic migrant if they come from Africa to Europe. So,
And then the other reason, one of the other reasons that people leave their countries is because of the effect of climate change.
Yeah.
And that's a disaster as well, because they're not doing anything to accelerate climate change. We're the Western world and are doing it, and yet they're paying the price. And then when they try to travel out of their country to come to us, we say no.
Yeah, and I was in Somalia actually twice last year reporting on they have at the moment a historic drought and a potential famine. It hasn't been declared as a famine, but I mean, arguably it is. And yeah, that is said to be as a result of climate change. I was in one displaced person's camp in December and I counted 101 graves of children under the age of 8 all in a row that had died in the previous few months. And yeah, I think people here, they're not aware. And I should say, by the way, you know, I'm a journalist. I'm not an activist. I'm not like advocating for any particular policy. But the important thing for me is that people actually understand the reality of the world we live in. And yeah, like what I think people here don't necessarily realize what's happening in other countries and the scale of the crises there.
Now, we've mentioned the EU. The UNHCR comes in for a lot of criticism in the book. And again, when people see the letters UN, they assume do-gooders. They're obviously doing good, but that's not always the case.
Yeah, I mean, my reporting on UNHCR began in Sudan. I visited there in 2017 and I was talking to refugees. You know, I was trying to report something actually slightly different and they were like, no, why don't you report on corruption within UNHCR? Because what they were saying is in the refugee resettlement program, so the kind of what people call, I guess, the queue when they talk about the queue or like safe and legal routes, there are very, very, very few safe and legal routes, but refugee resettlement is generally what people mean. And there's like a tiny proportion of places that are meant to be for the most vulnerable refugees to move to Western countries. And what they were saying is that this system has basically been corrupted, that people have to pay huge bribes, like a family might have to pay $20,000 to be considered for this scheme. And I started reporting on it. You know, that kind of blew my mind, to be honest. Like, I was like, you know, these are the good guys. I don't really understand how this could be happening. But I started reporting on it. I did publish an investigation after 10 months. I did manage to speak to UNHCR staff who told me that this was happening. And when we published it, the resettlement scheme, UNHCR suspended it nationwide, conducted their own investigation and did find one staff member guilty. But refugees say there, they say the situation is continuing. And UN investigators that I've interviewed about this happening in other places say when you have huge demand and no supply, basically, there's always room for exploitation.
You mentioned, it strikes me in your reporting of the UNHCR that The information that you were getting via Twitter and whatever, WhatsApp and whatever, they were saying that, okay, they arrive, the people arrive, but they don't come into the detention centres in Libya. It's like they don't want to get their hands dirty. One person communicated with you said they don't want to smell us.
Yeah, I mean, it's not correct that they were never going to detention centres, but for example, they would like call ahead. So they'd have to make an agreement to go there with the management. And obviously the management is going to do a cleanup. You know, they'll turn on the electricity. In one detention centre, I was told sick people were hidden, you know, tortured people were hidden so that they weren't seen when those UN visits happened. And I think, I mean, people can read the book for like the full, I don't want to spend too long like explaining, but one thing that became clear was that UNHCR was being funded or is being funded by the same pot of money that's aimed at stopping migration as the Libyan Coast Guard. And when you speak to European politicians, they would always say, you know, we don't approve, because you'd say, you know, your policies are responsible for crimes against humanity. People are being intercepted and forced back and locked up and this is what's happening to them. And they would say, we don't approve of the detention centres, but were supporting the UN to improve the conditions inside them. And that was kind of like their get out of jail free card, you know. Mm. So of course, when you interrogate that further, you go, actually, there's very limited amounts that the UN can do. And, you know, at the same stage, the UN would not publicly say why were people ending up in detention in the first place. Like, they'd thank the EU for their funding. They'd never say that they're there in the first place because of the EU. So it's all kind of like this, you know.
How did you feel questioning these huge organisations? And to all of us appeared, as you said, to be the good guys. Did you go, like, if I question them, they may not be able to do their work, or...
I mean, I think it's important to say that, like, a lot of, you know, I have sources everywhere. Like, a lot of my sources were inside these organizations. And I mean, only like this week, I got a message from someone in the EU saying, I'm so happy that you're doing this work. Like, people in the UN message me all the time. There's difference between what these big organizations say publicly and how their staff feel. And a lot of the staff were incredibly uncomfortable about the fact that they might be being used to whitewash the brutal impacts of EU policy. And a lot of European, you know, EU staff are very uncomfortable about what is happening. And I mean, yeah, obviously, like, you know, it would be great if they actually spoke out publicly, but I am getting information from those sources. It's not like it's me.
Of course. So the people that have been in contact with you, there are stories of torture, rape, suicide. Is it Mary or one of the people?
Yeah, who died.
Yeah, through suicide. And then Essie, he got out. And where is he living now?
In Luxembourg.
Right. What was his story?
He was actually one of the first people to contact me, and he was the first one that I managed to meet in person. It was about a year after I had been working on this, and I was being contacted all that time, like, by different people, hundreds of people I was in communication with. And he did manage to get out, and yeah, we met, and honestly, it was so strange because it was like, yeah, even something in your head is like, this, obviously I verified and everything, but something is like, maybe this can't be real. Like, how could this horrible thing be happening? And the role that I began to play was kind of so strange, in the sense that you're really talking to people at their darkest moments. And yeah, when we met in person, we talked, I think, at the beginning for like 10 hours. But I think I should say, by the way, because hopefully people listening will read the book, hopefully it's not like, it's not just stories of kind of torture and rape, and all of those things exist. But I tried to also put in kind of the normal life, the humanity of people, and the ways that they survive these difficult situations.
And that's important. I was watching a news report on Channel 4 last week with Patrick O'Brien. He's one of their, and he was in Calais. It was because of the proposed changes in law in the UK about sending migrants back. And he interviewed this guy. I can't remember whether he's from Nigeria or Somalia, but he had been in a detention centre in Libya. And Patrick O'Brien was saying to him, like, what about the risk of life, you know, crossing the English Channel? And your man as much said, like, not after what I've been through.
Yeah, and Patrick is actually mentioned in the text. I've worked with him before on Channel 4 News. I did a radio, a TV report for them. Actually, a few of them I helped produce.
There's a quote in the book called, "Nothing is worse than the past."
Is that from the end?
That's from one of your contacts said that in a message to you. Nothing is worse than the past. And that's, they've been through so much.
Yeah.
You know, that anything they face, like crossing the English Channel in a dinghy, you know, doesn't compare.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now, you got recordings as well from people, and you have, we just played three of them in. So this woman was a mother of twins. Can you just tell us about her? She's Eritrean.
Yeah, I think this was a recording sent to me from Kashir bin Gashir, which was a detention centre, which was actually shot up by a militia, and several people were killed. And I think this was sent shortly before then. Yeah.
Hello, I am from Eritrea. I am the mother of twins. They are very in bad condition. The world should make mercy for us. We need peace. We need freedom. We need to get out from the war. We need to get out of Libya. Libya, please, please help, help.
And some of these people had to ring back home and get money for the people who were detaining them.
Yeah, that was when they were held by smugglers generally, yeah.
Right. Now, smugglers get a lot of blame for a lot of things. So what your book explains to us is that it's not just the smugglers, that there's a lot more people involved.
I think what my book probably explains is that people, when they're desperate, they need to move. You know, sometimes it's so difficult to stay still, like you're being exploited, you're at risk anytime of being arrested, being detained, being killed. So if you need to move, then you're going, you know, if you can't get a legal route, you're going to use an illegal route. And smugglers and traffickers are there to take advantage of that. And so nobody's saying that they're good people. But, you know, it's too easy to just say we need to stop the smuggling business, because it's not going to stop while people are in need of moving. And yeah, people who are interested, I mean, there's two smugglers slash traffickers who are in the book who actually got arrested, and I attended their trials in Ethiopia. And they've now, one has been extradited to the Netherlands and one is in the UAE. But yeah, that was like...
So what effect has your book had?
In terms of the effect, I mean, it's hard to fully say. I think that more people, like, I'm honestly, I'm so grateful to anyone who reads it, I should say. Like, I know that it's a difficult subject. And at the same stage, like, my goal in all of this was to make sure that nobody can say that they don't know that this is happening, and that they can't say, you know, this is happening in our names, and therefore everybody privileged needs to pay attention. It's not kind of a niche journalism topic. This is about how the rich world is treating the rest of the world. And it's not even a topic about, you know, Libya and North Africa, or even about Italy or Malta. It's like literally about the rich world and the rest of the world. And we're seeing these tactics, you know, different countries are borrowing similar tactics from each other now. And we can see that with all the current discourse in the UK or even in the US. In terms of the impact, there have been various things. It was referenced in a submission to the International Criminal Court last year, calling for named European politicians and officials to be prosecuted for crimes against humanity. It has been used in the legal challenge against the UK Rwanda deportation plan. And yeah, I mean, you know, I've been approached by like people from all over, politicians, UN officials, like lots of people saying that it's changed, either changed their thinking or that they're so grateful that it has been exposed, because they have not wanted this to continue. But at the same stage, they say until the general public actually cares, nothing is going to happen. And yeah, so in some senses, there's been an impact, and in some senses, there hasn't at all. And so I'm so grateful to anybody who just pays attention to this.
My fourth time, we drowned on Post Irish Book of the Year, numerous awards. Rave reviews. Congratulations, Sally Hayden. I'm sure we'll be talking again. And mind yourself.
Thank you so much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Gramagad Mara, thank you very much. 51551 ray at RTE.ie. We cannot take the whole world into the EU. Fine for Ukrainians. They've been invaded, but economic migrants from other countries must go through the legal mechanisms. There are lots of people from countries worse off than we are here in Ireland. It doesn't mean they have a right to come here. That's ludicrous. These people need to stay and improve their own countries, like post-war Germany, Japan and Korea, says that person. And Sheila says, I read Sally's book last year. She's a brave and fantastic journalist. I think it's one of the most important books ever written. So Sheila, so maybe we could suggest to the other texter that they read the book. I'm just looking at the back of the new edition of it, the paperback, they call it, because the one I have is a paperback as well, but this is the paperback version. The triumph of the book is to inject a renewed urgency and moral clarity into a story most people think they are familiar with. I think that's it. We all think we know what's going on, but we don't. And that's the why Sally's book is so important, because it lays it out there, and she's a brilliant writer as well. So it's very readable. It's very engaging. It's horrific in parts and very upsetting, and you'll be frustrated and you'll be angry, but you will understand what's going on in the world a lot better at the end of it. Now, we've two quizzers standing by to play our Who Done a Quiz. And there's a prize, and it's a two-night stay in Fota Island, fotaisland.ie. They've loads going on down there, swimming pools and world-class spas, exclusive cove restaurant. There's golf, and there's the wildlife park, Fota House and Gardens. And then it's a stone's throw from Cork City, 8 miles to be exact. And then you can go to Ballymaloe or Ballycotton or whatever. Photoisland.ie. Yes. Hello, Antoinette Farley.
Hello, Ray.
How are things in Cavan?
Good, good. Apart from the weather is terrible.
Yeah. You're in the middle of making the dinner.
Yeah. Well, we're finished now. Well, I made the dinner yesterday, and so we're finished eating it for the day.
Oh, you're finished.
We have more for tomorrow.
Oh, you've your dinner in the middle of the day.
Yeah. Well, when you've got school kiddies, you just eat when they're eating.
Oh, yeah. So what ages are the kiddies?
5, 3, and 1.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're done and dusted now. The main meal's gone. What you have?
Oh, lasagna.
What?
Lasagna.
Yeah, lasagna. Homemade.
Yeah.
From scratch.
Yeah. I batch cooked last night, so.
Right.
We have more for tomorrow as well.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And the day after, and the day after.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Is that lasagna again, Mammy? Is it? Yeah. So what's the plan for St. Patrick's Day?
Just go to a couple of parades that start around the county.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Anya's probably the only one in school, is she?
Yeah, and Aidan, he's in play school.
Right, and does Anya have tomorrow off?
Yeah, she does.
Yes, a lot of primary schools seem to have it off. Tom has tomorrow off as well, so it's a long weekend for them.
Yeah, nice. I was hoping to go to Dublin tomorrow, but then I don't know if the weather's going to be like this. I think I'll just stay put and do some arts and crafts or something.
Yeah, it's weather dependent. your fans are weather dependent, yeah. There'll be a good buzz around Dublin tomorrow, I'd say, you know, with a lot of tourists in for the St. Patrick's Day.
It's kicking off.
You're up against Breda Cameron from Killinard in County Laois. Hello, Breda.
Hi, Ray, how are you?
Good. You're coming in loudly and clearly from Killinard. What's your plan for St. Patrick's Day?
Well, Ray, we're actually on the way to the west of Ireland at the moment, so I'm pulled in a car park at the moment in just off the Ennis Road.
Right.
And we're heading to the west, and we hope to attend at least one of the parades.
So west where? Where west?
County Clare.
Okay, yes. So are you going out to the coast?
We will, we're staying, close enough to Spanish Point.
Okay, yeah. Quilty is there as well, isn't it, around there?
Quilty's a good spot as well, that's right.
Yeah. We were speaking to a lady from Kilrush earlier on. How far are you from Kilrush out in Spanish Point?
Oh, gosh, I'd say it's not too far. Probably 30, maybe 35 kilometres, maybe.
Yeah. Well, they have a parade, just so you know.
That's it, yeah. I heard her, yeah.
So you're there for the weekend, Breed, are you?
We are, yes.
Right. So big day for the rugby on Saturday. Really looking forward to 5 o'clock. We play England in the Aviva Stadium. And if we win, we are winning the Grand Slam. And it's the first time we'll win it on home ground, Breda. Very exciting.
That's right. Yeah. Very exciting. Yeah. Very, very exciting. Yeah. Yes. So really, really looking forward to that, Ray.
So we're waiting to hear what our injuries are because we had a number of them against Scotland last Sunday, yeah. So wait and see, fingers crossed. It's looking good though, isn't it?
I think it's looking good. I think Ringrose is still out though, isn't he?
He won't be back, yes. And the two hookers, we're waiting to see if they're okay. So there's a lot of people on the injury list. Anyway, okay, 3 questions each. Antoinette and Breda, I'll give you the category. You tell me if you want a clue or not. If you go for a clue, it's easier, so you get a point. If you go without a clue, you get 2 points. Whoever has the most points at the end is the winner. And if it's a drawing points, we go to a tiebreak question. Good luck to you both. Here we go.
Okay,
Antoinette. In Cavan, music is our first category. Would you like a clue or not?
No clue.
No clue. Okay.
No.
For 2 points.
No clue.
Who is this?
Gwen Stefani.
Say again.
Gwen Stefani.
Oh, you're in there straight away. Well done. It is Gwen Stefani. Yeah. We let her sing it out there. There you go. There it is. Gwen Stefani. Sweet Escape. From 2006. Okay. She's put it up to you, Breda. Yeah.
Okay.
Music as well. Do you want a clue or not?
I better go no clue. I have to follow Antoinette. Well done, Antoinette.
Okay. Right. For 2 points, who is this?
This girl is on fire. This girl is on fire. She's walking on fire.
Who's that?
Gosh, I should know it. My granddaughter sings it.
Yeah.
I can't think.
No.
Oh, gone.
Alicia Keys. This girl
Alicia Keys.
Yeah, she performed at the Queen's Jubilee.
Okay.
Yeah, amazing singer. Okay, early days, Breeda, don't fret. Back to you, Antoinette. The second category is cartoon characters.
No clue.
No clue, okay.
No.
So we're looking for the character's name for 2 points. Who's this?
And now for Antoine's recipe. First, shake well, then stuff with hot sauce, chili peppers, bay leaf, bay rum, hot mustard, horseradish, mule radish, and a dash of Tabasco sauce.
But I can't think of his name.
Then pour into stew pot.
Any
the pig
ideas?
With the gun. The pig with the gun, but I can't think. No, I can't give a name.
You were thinking about the wrong character anyway. He ain't a pig, he's a rabbit. That's Bugs Bunny. What's up, Doc?
Oh, right.
Yeah,
okay.
There you go. See when you can't see them. Okay.
And all the years of watching the den, huh?
Yeah. It was all wasted on you. Wasted on you.
Yeah,
okay.
I was looking at the presenters.
Now I'm blushing. Right, Breeda, cartoon characters. Do you want a clue or not?
Oh, I better go. No clue.
No clue. Okay, for two. Who is this?
What could be more important than a little something to eat? Or perhaps a little large or something? Oh, not to worry, Tommy. I always know what to do.
Well?
I haven't a clue, Ray.
No. Guess? No.
No.
No. Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Right, now, you're not out of it yet, Breeda, although Antoinette is in a good position. She's on 2, you haven't scored yet. Antoinette, if you get anything from this, Breeda can't catch you. That's important information.
Yeah.
It's important
information. I'll take the clue.
You'll take the clue, yes. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So,
I can feel the elbow in the ribs there.
Yeah. The category is film. Here's your clue. Listen carefully. If you get this right, you are today's winner.
Okay.
When she's not too busy, she spends her time at Downton Abbey. Right? So, who is this actor? When she's not too busy, she spends her time at Downton Abbey.
The House of Godric Gryffindor has commanded the respect of the wizard world for nearly 10 centuries. I will not have you in the course of a single evening besmirching that name by behaving like a babbling, bumbling band of baboons.
I don't know.
I can see her face, but I don't know. I never watched that show.
Maggie Smith there, Professor McGonagall.
Name doesn't ring a bell at all.
Harry Potter, yes. Okay, now, that makes it interesting. You're still on 2, Antoinette. Breeda, you haven't scored yet, but if you get 2 out of this, it brings us to a tie-break question. But you do have to go without a clue. Well, you've no choice, really. There's no point in going.
No choice.
Yes, there's no point. Okay, it's all or nothing. All or nothing for you, Breeda. So for 2 points, film... Who is this, or even this?
And I miss the days where you had one phone number and one answering machine. And that one answering machine housed one cassette tape. And now you just have to go around checking all these different portals just to get rejected by 7 different technologies.
Well.
I haven't a clue, right?
No. If you got that, I would be amazed. Drew Barrymore.
The
clue was this person first appeared in our screens in E.T. in 1982, which is a good clue. She was a child actor, but no points there. Breeda, we're going to send you out a Ray Darcy Show Keep Cup to put in your cup holder there in your car as you travel around the country. Enjoy your weekend away in Clare and enjoy the rugby as well. Lovely talking to you, Breeda.
Will do. Thank you, Wayne. Well done, Antoinette. Take care.
Thank you, Wayne. Have a good weekend.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Antoinette, you're going to be making the journey from Cavan to Cork. Yay!
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Thanks a million, Ray.
Photoisland.ie, yourself and a person of your choice, and you may ring them. You might bring the whole family. I'm sure that they'll be able to accommodate you there if you...
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah, so photoisland.ie. Photoisland.ie. Well done, Antoinette.
Thank
Have a lovely
Ray.
Weekend.
Have a
See you now. Bye,
Thank
bye,
you.
Bye, bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Could you give a big shout out to the Sanctuary Runners who are Grand Marshals for the Cork City Parade on Friday. Such a wonderful statement of inclusion, welcome and kindness in the real capital. We can't wait. That's Graeme Clifford. And that's a great organisation, the Sanctuary Runners. So I'm delighted to see that they're featuring in the Cork Parade. Now, Ray O'Neill, Nelson Keating, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And Ray and Alison are here to give you advice on relationship problems you may be going through. And we'll get straight to it, will we? We've a good few to get through. Hi, Ray and Alison. I'm with my partner for many years now. And while we've had conflicts and arguments over the years, we are now committing and having a baby together and engaged. While I do love him, we are both very stubborn and dislike being in the wrong during an argument. I've learned to keep my cool or hold my tongue over the years and have asked him many times if we can take a break and speak calmly about things once regulated. He agrees once he calms down and says he will try not to let it happen again, but most recently he flew completely off the handle, calling me all sorts of names, a disgusting human being included, when we argued over something that I said that wasn't very nice and hurt his feelings. I'm not trying to make him take the blame and I apologise where I am wrong, but the words he uses really hurt me and his apology doesn't take that away. How can I make our house a more stable environment for our little baby and our future? Wow, that's a big question, isn't it?
That's a great question. Yeah. Okay, so you know where she says, I learned to keep my cool and hold my tongue over the years. I would like to break the myth. If you've nothing nice to say, don't say it. Because sometimes the feelings that you have, such as anger, it's an important emotion and it's an information cue. So actually listening to it and saying in a way that someone else can hear. You don't have to shout at somebody, but expressing that you're unhappy about something. People are so terrified of anger and conflict in relationships and actually to be in a healthy relationship. Because what I'm hearing here is we need everything to be perfect. For our baby that's coming. To be quite honest, you need to know how to manage conflict now and you're going to have to learn how to manage it even more so. The second thing is when she's saying, and I think it's really great, you know, let's talk about it when we're regulated, but don't confuse regulation with suppression. So I think it's really important to understand that we need to kind of understand when we're triggered by something and that's when the hurtful personal things come out. Mm. But maybe there's been too much kind of keeping it under wraps for a while. And perhaps they need to discuss the things that are really upsetting them because she said something that upset him so much that he burst, he triggered, yes. And said, you know, you're a disgusting human being. We all say stupid, bad things in arguments. Like even when it's here, like, you know, it's not full of cursing and personal. It's a hurt response from him. So it's to kind of go, what's actually going on here? What do we need to talk about? How are we going to soothe real wounds here and actually fix them rather than stick a little plaster on top?
Yes. Ray, it sounds like it goes from 0 to 100.
Yeah.
And again, I think...
Very quickly, sorry, yes.
Yeah, no,
sorry.
Oh, for me to be very quick, do you want me to go from 0 to 100? Okay, right. Yeah, look, you have to learn how to fight the good fight in every relationship. Like, it's not, and I think Alison's absolutely named something there. Sometimes you can aggravate somebody else if I'm, say, agitated and you're being really calm and whether that's controlling or suppressing, you're like, I'm really passionate, I'm really in a flow and I'm dealing with stone here. So sometimes it is about meeting someone with energy raised, but not necessarily to the explosive point. This couple need to have a safety word. Mm. They need to have some little cue that says, okay, we're gone to a bad place now.
Does that work?
Yes. Yes. Definitely.
All right. And would you suggest that to your clients?
Definitely.
Absolutely. Right. I suggest it to myself.
And
right.
I suggest it to my husband too. And both of us. And it's actually really good.
So something's escalating.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you go, pineapple.
Or even just like we need to pause.
Okay.
Like sometimes, you know, because that pineapple will pop out of your head at the wrong time. So you just
and the
pause.
benefit of a word like that is that you've agreed on it beforehand.
Yes.
So it's not like somebody just leaving the room.
Absolutely.
Because they are taking control then, and that aggravates the situation.
They understand that when the safety word is being used, that all interaction has to just cease. Desist for the moment, whether that takes 30 seconds, but it is the emergency alert button that de-escalates rather than goes nuclear.
And is there a case here that I said 0 to 100, but maybe things are bubbling under and they're at a constant 60, so it doesn't take much to tip it over the edge. So you need to deal with those things first, whatever is causing the 60%.
And so potentially sitting down when things are calm and having in a jar, look, here are the flashing points. Here are the points that we row over. Let's just pick one out of the jar. And if we're both okay with it, let's talk about that for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But when you're in a better place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's where regulation is amazing.
I've never seen that word used in that context before. So is it a buzzword now, regulation?
Well, it's kind of like what we actually all need to know about, to be honest. Right. I mean, you know, our nerves are like when we did Then Comes Marriage. I thought it was absolutely brilliant when we had the people hooked up to heart monitors and it looked like two people and a couple were having a conversation, nothing was happening. But there was one couple and their heart rate was going through the roof. But to look at the person, they were completely would never calm. Have known.
Yeah.
So our bodies tell a different story. They really do. And to learn how to regulate your emotions is one of the key skills, I think.
And should you share? Say for example, so a conversation starts. Should you go, my heart rate's increasing?
Absolutely.
You should say that.
Yeah.
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 Right. Just because sometimes the other person may not
doesn't
see
know.
It.
They
and they're not trying to be
yes.
cruel.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where we just like, we do make this common thing that we're all the same. Mm-hmm. And we have so much in common, but we all do things differently.
Yeah. And we react to things and we're triggered by different things, all because of our background and our childhood and everything else. Yeah. Okay, so what's the advice here then? It's the password, what do you call it?
Safety word.
Pick it yourselves.
And the jar with the things that might be contentious, pick them out. At a time when things are calm and discuss them.
And it will take time to learn this, but that's time well spent.
And the other thing, it doesn't solve everything, but a baby in a relationship can take the emphasis off the two people and the priorities change and it can be a calming influence.
Or not.
Sorry. I know. I said can be. I didn't say will be. Okay. Hi, Ray and Alison. I have a father-in-law who is very interfering and my partner does exactly what he says or advises. I voiced my opinion many times only for it to end in a row of how good said father-in-law is to us. How can I solve this? He is very do it my way or no way kind of man who does not like to be told he is wrong, etc. I have found out the hard way he no longer speaks to me. This is awkward as he lives very close to us. Father-in-law. Right.
Yeah, in-laws and outlaws. Always the source. Look, I think the fact that the father-in-law and this person have fallen out already, he no longer speaks to me, a line has already been drawn. And how much can your partner expect you to engage or embrace or accept a man who is so rude and so cruel to his son's partner? So just here, I suppose, when you're having these arguments, try and move the conversation away from good and bad. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you're not saying the dad is a bad person, the father-in-law is a bad person. You just say, look, that isn't helpful. That isn't constructive. I don't find that useful. Because once we start using the terms good and bad, it all gets laden with morals and ethics.
Right. So that's not helping me. That's not useful.
It's
right.
a much more constructive way to move a conversation forward rather than your father's no good or your father's bad.
Mm. Mm. I'd say this person, like the son or her partner, feels really stuck. And I'd actually ask him what it's like for him to be in this situation, what it was like for him growing up with a father who perhaps was quite controlling or conditional on being an authoritarian. Thank you. An authoritarian.
That's one word I can't say.
You know, so that, like, this father's used to being in control. They're used to getting their own way. And the word that made me a little uncomfortable was, you know, that how good he is and is there financial implications in that? And that power worries me because it's not fair. But I would be very curious if this person goes back to their partner and says, what was it like for you growing up in a household like that? You know, what is it about our relationship that you actually like? How do you want things to be different? But to really come at it from a place of compassion that you understand that I think this person's really stuck in a major family dynamics that perhaps he does feel but can't actually say.
Yeah. And because they live so close to each other, it needs to be sorted, doesn't it?
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I hope that works out. Now, looking at the clock, we have time for this. Hi, Ray and Alison. It's got to the stage where I need some advice. It's bugging me now. I've always been happy in my relationship. We've been together almost 12 years. We're both happy, I hope. The only thing that's starting to get to me is how much more valued her family are rather than mine when it comes to celebrations and meeting up. We're always going to her parents' house for dinner and lunches and birthday and Mother's Day, etc. And when I suggest we do the same for my side of the family, it's met with eye rolls and obstacles. It's not that she doesn't get on with my family. She does, and they love her. But I just know she'd rather not spend the little time we have together with them. I feel bad always saying we can't go to parties or celebrations with my family when almost every weekend we're doing something with hers. I also don't want her to think I'm moaning or comparing, but it's definitely on my mind now, so I need to do or say something. Yes, you do. What do you suggest, Alison?
I think bring what you've said here to her. I think it's perfectly said. And also, this might be a situation where you get in there first. And I mean that in a very genuine way. Some families plan ahead and then other families are like, oh, let's get together this weekend. And it mightn't be a kind of a devious thing here that, you know, but it depends on the family's norm. So some families, I think, can plan, like, what are you doing next Christmas? And then other people are like, I don't know what I'm doing this weekend. So I think that could be somewhere where you could start. And just, I would say exactly what you've said here.
Yeah.
It's really honest. It's really measured. But you have a right to express that it's actually not okay for you, and the bugging you actually could cause a problem.
Can I suggest maybe that she doesn't say, or he doesn't say, that they sent it into a radio show? that might just annoy them.
Yeah.
So just
Ray Darcy told me to say this to you.
He's coming around on Saturday.
I'm responsible for the following bit of advice.
Yeah. What about you, Ray?
I think, like, again, a lot of things happen unconsciously, so the partner may not even be aware of this. So it may sound quite pedantic, but actually start writing down with her agreement. Listen, this is my sense. I could be wrong on this, but do you mind if we start marking down on the fridge the times we go to your family and the times we go to my family, just so we can both keep an eye on that? Right. I just think then you have a visual that is a fact, and you can't do this retroactively. Yeah. You have to do it now. And it does seem pedantic, but it does work, because the concern is in the last line here. You know, I need to say, do or say something now, because God forbid something happen to one of his family, that will become a resentment. Right. I never got to see my brother and now he's gone.
Yes, yeah.
So that's why life is important. You do the things when people are with us. And of course she enjoys spending time with her own family. They're her family. But she has to appreciate she's in a partnership.
Yeah.
And sometimes we turn up for those work events because our partner wants us to.
Yeah. And she does, she says, it's not that she doesn't get on with my family. She does, and they love her. But I just know she'd rather spend time with her own family. That's it. But like, relationships are compromise, aren't they?
Give and
yes,
take.
Yeah. Yeah. Compromise, give and take, give and take. Well, thanks for giving your advice today. And we're taking our leave. Thanks, Alison.
Thank you.
Cheers, Ray.
That's it from us. Sarah and Cormac are on the way with Drive Time. We are back tomorrow with a bit of sort of, I suppose, St. Patrick's Day Eve celebrations. Join us then, 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening. Here we go, this one. Yeah.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.